Blog Talk Radio.
This is for you, Kings fans, wherever you may be. All the frustration and disappointment of the past is gone.
It's March 28th. It's time for the 7th episode of the Jewelcast this season. It'll be our second to last episode, I think, of the regular season, fingers crossed, with one more sort of wrap-up after the next five games. And these next five games are going to be very interesting. The Kings are sitting in a decent spot, at least by the percentages. The problem is that there are three other teams that are sitting in the exact same spot or close to it, and of those four teams, only three of them are going to get in. So we have a lot to talk about with the playoff race, but also with some more recent developments with the Kings. So I know a lot has happened since the last Jewelcast. We've had injuries. We've had certain American heroes coming back from injury. A garbage truck hit a pole outside my house and took out my power and internet. It's been a busy few weeks. So we're back now, and I believe today we are going to hear from three of our other writers as well. To start, I think we've got two of them on. So, Sarah and Robin, are you here?
Hello.
Howdy.
That's one. That's two. Great. So, we are set. Let's launch right into it. So, we are going to start as I think everyone in the hockey media is starting, with the current playoff race. The East is pretty simple. We already know seven-ish of the teams, at the very least, Philly can hang on. And we know that New Jersey and Florida are fighting for that eighth spot as it stands. In the West, it's not exactly complicated, but it is messy. We've got the St. Louis Blues, the Colorado Avalanche, the Anaheim Ducks, and the Los Angeles Kings fighting for the last three spots in the West. So I'll start with you, Robin. If you had to guess right now, do you think the Kings get in as it stands?
That's kind of a loaded question. Because
yes, and that's why we're starting with this.
Past history says both yes and no, they won't get in, and or says yes, they will get in, and no, they won't get in. And if we go with decade, so I'm meaning since 2010, then there's a good chance they will get in. But the last 3 years have scarred me, and I'm going to say that this is a team that could utterly fail to make the playoffs by 1 point.
All right, we'll start there then. Sarah, what's your thought?
I'm still holding on to my preseason prediction of they squeak in, partly because I refuse to admit that I'm wrong about anything, and partly I just have to have hope that they pull it together. And of all of those three teams, that one of them is going to be knocked out, any of them would be really satisfying to not see in the playoffs. So I really hope that they do it just to have them like, oops, Anaheim didn't make it. Oh, darn.
So I guess then the place to start, because we're going to spend the next, hour and a half talking about the Kings and only the Kings. Let's go through the other three teams real quick. So the remaining schedule is slightly varied for each one. The Kings, as you probably know, have four home games out of their last five. They do play both Anaheim and Colorado, who they're in direct competition with. The other teams are Minnesota, who is all but in the playoffs at this point, and Arizona and Dallas, who are all but out. Colorado has both Anaheim, L.A., and, well, they've got all three teams. They've got Anaheim, L.A., and St. Louis in their schedule. St. Louis only has to play Colorado of those teams, and they've got the rest of their games against teams who are pretty much decided. And Anaheim, I think, has the exact same schedule as L.A., apart from, of course, the game they're playing against each other. So let's start with that question. Robin, of the other three teams, who do you think would be the team that would be the odd team out if L.A. gets in?
You know, I would love to see Anaheim miss the playoffs because it'd be hilarious.
Sure.
But reasonably, I'm going to bet on St. Louis to miss because they're not quite as deep as they were a few years ago. And Armstrong, their GM, he's made a lot of changes to a lot of tweaks to kind of try and make them a better, more well-rounded team, that I think he just kind of dealt away a lot of their talent.
Sure, and they're, I think, at least if you look at the teams and where they were a couple weeks ago, St. Louis is certainly the unlikeliest to be here now. They got criticized at the deadline for sort of selling as opposed to buying, and looked like that was the right move, and now they have won seven in a row to get back into it, which I guess would make it even more the right move if they were able to give up players and still stay in there. Sarah, do you agree that St. Louis is the team that's ripe for the picking, or are you assuming they're just going to win out because that's how it's been going the last few weeks?
You know, At first I was thinking St. Louis would probably be the one to miss out, but their record lately has been ridiculous, and they did the exact same thing last year. At the deadline, they traded Kevin Shattenkirk to the Capitals because they were like, well, you know, whatever. We may or may not make it, but, like, they didn't see them as being a cup team that year, so they just kind of got rid of an asset. And then St. Louis made it. And I kind of see them doing the same thing this year, which I hate because I don't like them.
Sure.
I kind of see Colorado missing. They've proved to be a formidable team, but, I mean, as we just saw ourselves the other day, you know, they also can get lit up for no good reason other than because Anze Kopitar is amazing. I don't feel like Colorado is entirely as consistent as maybe they would want to be, and so my hot take is that maybe they'll miss.
Yes, but caveat, they have Hart winner, well, he's probably going to win the Hart, Nathan McKinnon.
The
Hart winner in waiting. Yeah, I think, I don't know. I think my, at least when I was talking about it earlier today, I was actually going opposite you guys. I was thinking that Anaheim was going to be the odd team out if LA didn't get in. And I was more thinking that if Anaheim and LA play on Friday and one of the teams wins in regulation, the other one is just in deep trouble. And that can go for a lot of the other teams, I'm assuming, in a lot of the other matchups down the stretch. But Anaheim, for one, they really kind of beefed it yesterday when they couldn't afford to. But also, they're a team that you think is more likely to give away points if they're leading late in the game. They might let teams into overtime if they're, you know, given the way they've played at least recently. St. Louis isn't looking very vulnerable, but if they decide they want to play like they played the last few months, they're very weak. But I think it, you know, and this is maybe from a position of not knowing St. Louis and Colorado quite as well as I know Anaheim and LA, but it feels like these Pacific teams, one of them is going to struggle with the home stretch. So I'm just hoping it's not LA, but it's really a toss up. And I think we'll put up a poll tomorrow on the site just to see where everyone's head is at. We do know that Colorado is in action tonight, and they're starting in about a half hour. So we'll provide some updates on how that's going and live and die with what's happening 1,000 miles away. So in the meantime, the focus for LA is, of course, taking care of their own stuff, especially since they've been not getting too much help from the rest of the league. Of course, they have been getting a lot of help from Anže Kopitar. And Robin, you brought up the heart race, and it's all I've been seeing on my timeline and all I've been hearing about, like, when I was at Staples, for example, on Monday, is Kopitar, does he even have a chance? And more importantly, does he have an argument? And it's kind of silly to talk about it with the playoff run in full swing, but given how many of the other contenders are also in this kind of race, it's kind of fun to go over. So we'll switch it up and go to Sarah first. Do you think Kopitar's heart argument has legs, and if so, why?
I think it has legs as long as someone is actually looking at numbers. And I know there's always kind of the half joke, half it's true, no one watches the West Coast games because they're all on the East Coast and they're asleep kind of thing. But you know, so that probably does contribute a little bit to it, to why people aren't paying enough attention to him. Do I think he wins? Probably not. I think he definitely has a case to be a finalist there. But like a lot of media people have been saying, there's so many players who have good cases that you could look at five media guys' ballots and they could have five different names on them, and they all could be pretty valid choices. But I think that, you know, the way he's really stepped up this year, you know, bouncing back after a bad year, really carrying the team offensively without Jeff Carter for most of the year, you know, I think it really shows how important he's been to this team, even, you know, just keeping them steady whenever things have looked bad. You know, as Kings fans, we can't ever overstate how great he is. And it seems like he's starting to finally get a little bit more notice for how good of a leader he is, not just, you know, the player and, you know, oh, the gentleman, the lady being kind of stuff. Like, seeing the well-rounded, you know, how important he is to the team, I think is really starting to get more notice, which is excellent.
And we've definitely tried to overstate it, how good Kopitar is, for the last, 8 years. And we're finally at the point, I think, I want to say his highest finish was 8th, and I will check that. But Robin, what do you think Kopitar's, like, what do you think supports Kopitar's heart case? Like, what if he wins or if he has a strong finish, what's the biggest reason why?
The biggest thing that I've seen is that, like Bergeron, is that he has 39% of his team's percentage points. And there's, like, besides Bergeron, there's, I think, like, one or two other people who come close. That's it. I think it's, like, Nathan MacKinnon, Patrice Bergeron, and Anže Kopitar, and they all have, like, between 38 and 40% of their team's percentage points. Mm-hmm. And so in the national guys, or at least the other media guys that I've seen, that kind of seems to be, like, one of their biggest sticking points. It's like, oh, he's got a lot of the team
sure.
care of the point. Like, okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think other than those guys you mentioned, and maybe like a Connor McDavid, that's probably his biggest case. And I think it's a moot point if the Kings don't make the playoffs. I think Kopitar doesn't sniff the top three. I think that's, unless you're McDavid or maybe MacKinnon, whose scoring totals are just off the charts, you're probably not going to have a chance to win if you're not in the playoffs. And that debate has been raging, and I'm already sick of it. But for Kopitar himself, I mean, Sarah, do you think that this is the year that the voters sort of try to argue for a more complete game winning the award?
I would like to think so, but now I was just thinking about all the people on Twitter I've been really tempted to mute who are going back and forth arguing over whether or not your team should have to be in the playoffs to be considered MVP
mm-hmm.
and whether or not Connor McDavid should be the MVP, even though he made his team be like 26th best instead of 28th best. And like, I'm just Twitter until it's over. I need the voting to happen right now so I don't have to hear it anymore.
Yeah.
I think it's a bigger conversation over like what really, it's like whenever they have the Masterson Award and someone always, you know, brings up, well, it doesn't mean that you had to survive something really horrible. Like, you know, what does the award really mean? And so I feel like this year's kind of sparking a debate on what, you know, what this award is really meant for. Like, what does it really, it's very like philosophical. Like, what does it mean to be mm-hmm. most valuable? But, you know, I do think that, you know, if you're looking at who is the most valuable player, like, yeah, you need to take a holistic look at, you know, how this person not only performs offensively, but defensively. Like, scoring 100 goals isn't, you know, all that important if you're also on the ice for a million goals at the same time. So I think that, you know, that is something that, you know, Kopitar has going in his favor, is that he's such a well-rounded player, and hopefully more people are taking notice of that now.
Yeah, and I think that it is going to burst through the surface, at least this year, because Bergeron and Taves and Kopitar, who have sort of historically been considered the primary, oh, their point totals don't really sum up how well they play and how good players they are. Bergeron finished fifth in the Hart voting in 2013-14, which is his highest finish, and he did it with 62 points in 80 games. His career high in points is 73, which was actually his second season in the NHL 12 years ago. Jonathan Taves, his career high in points is 76. That year he finished sixth in the Hart, and then a couple years later in the lockout-shortened season, he put up a point a game and he finished fourth. So this is neither Taves nor Bergeron has ever been a Hart finalist, and I think if Kopitar does manage to at least crack the top three, I think you're right. I think it's going to bring that decision that discussion to the forefront. Because 88 points for Kopitar is far and away the most that any of those three guys have ever put up, which is very satisfying for Kings fans. But I think it is going to at least generate the discussion, which I still find kind of interesting. But I also agree needs to not be just the constant refrain for the next 2 months. Robin, on that note, the four-goal game that Andre Kopitar put up in Colorado, is, I don't know if you want to go out on a limb, but is that the best individual performance you've seen from Kopitar?
From an offensive and individual standpoint, yes. But, you know, there have been other games where he has set up his teammates. I mean, I one of my favorite goals is actually not his goal. It's the alley-oop goal that I think it's from, like, 2011 that he set up Dustin Brown with this insane lob pass from back in his own zone, and Dustin Brown dekes out the goalie and scores. But from an individual standpoint, yeah, I think that's definitely one of his best games.
Mm-hmm. And in sort of the timing of it, too, that was, I don't think Kopitar is in the Hart discussion if he doesn't score four goals in Colorado in the middle of a playoff race with Colorado nipping at LA's heels, or I guess I should say LA nipping at Colorado's heels. It's in terms of timing, it's one of the coolest things I've seen in the regular season as a Kings fan in quite some time. Sarah, was there a warning sign that something like this was going to happen? Did you expect even a hat trick at this point from Kopitar, or were you expecting more quiet consistency rather than that kind of explosion?
I definitely just expected same old, quiet, consistent Kopitar. I missed that game live because I instead decided to torment myself by going to watch the Canucks play in Chicago, which, I mean, the Canucks won, which was really funny, and I got to say that I saw the Sedins play hockey, you know. But other than that, like, I was like, I missed four Anze Kopitar goals for this. I did not expect that. I don't know that I ever expected him to have a game like that. And I actually was just rewatching the game this morning, because I have nothing better to do because I'm sick and I needed something I didn't have to pay that much attention to. And so I was kind of watching it in the background and like there was no, I knew what was coming and there was still like no sign like that it was going to happen. He just played like a quiet game. And all of those goals that he got, they just happened. Like, you blinked, and there was in the net. It was very unexpected, and I'm real glad it happened, especially right now, especially when everyone was pumping Nate McKinnon's tires and talking about him the whole game, and then, oops, there's Kopitar. Mm-hmm. Like, it was very timely, and I hope that he got great satisfaction out of it.
Yeah, our friends at Mile High Hockey, the Colorado blog, took a little bit of heat during that game because they decided to tweet something about how McKinnon was going to solidify his hold on the Hart Trophy on national television. And in fairness, none of us expected Kopitar to go for 4 goals at that point. And in fairness, McKinnon probably is still going to win this trophy if Colorado gets in. But I was looking in. From one perspective, it was a standout game for Kopitar beyond the 4 goals in that it was the most shots he's had all year, too. Like this, he's put up 4 shots in a game 15 times this year, so at least 4 shots on goal in a game 15 times this year. He had 7 that night. The second most he actually had was the 7-2 loss to St. Louis a couple weeks earlier, a game in which he tried and was very unsuccessful in taking that game over, although he did have 2 assists as well. So there is, I think, an element of Kopitar. You know, there's, for better or for worse, there was a narrative in the past that Kopitar didn't, you know, drag his team to victory. He couldn't elevate the players around him, and I think he's put that argument almost totally to bed this year if he hadn't done so already in the past. The last thing I'll go ahead. What was that?
all I wanted to say was Taylor Hall. That is all.
he's got the Kopitar East argument. He's got the huge gap over the second leading scorer on the team. He's got I am dragging this team that would otherwise not be in the playoff picture with my bare hands, but. I don't know who the finalists are going to be. I think
streak, which basically put him at the forefront of the Hart argument.
Yeah. Well, I'll ask you. Do you think that any of these guys win the Hart or have a you know, would finish in the top 3 if they miss the playoffs? I'm excluding McDavid from this.
If they miss the playoffs. At this moment, I think it's between McKinnon and Taylor Hall, depending on if the teams make the playoffs. If they don't make the playoffs, then I think Taylor Hall still has a shot because of his insane scoring streak. I mean, like 28 straight games to the point. But I think
McKinnon
had like 14. Mm-hmm. 20 games or something like that with a point as well.
Yeah, and I think if you look at it that way, Kopitar certainly doesn't have that kind of streak on his resume. He's certainly got the consistency. He hasn't had many scoreless streaks this year, whereas I think a guy like Hall might have been more prone to that earlier in the season. But it'll be interesting to watch unfold, and maybe we are arguing about it too early because once this playoff picture shakes out, we'll have some new things to talk about. So I think as we talk about the rest of the Kings then, because they are still a 23-man roster, even if we only have eyes for Kopitar sometimes, we on Monday saw Jake Muzzin go hard into the boards thanks to Michael Furland, who, go figure, Calgary is missing all their top guys, including Matthew Tkachuk, and then the guy who hits everything that moves that we kind of forgot about goes and drills Jake Muzzin. So Muzzin is listed as week to week. John Stevens, coach of the Kings, was quoted earlier today as saying these kind of things can turn around real fast, which is a nice thing to hear, but I still think Muzzin's out for at least the rest of the regular season. So there are a few, I think, points to ponder with Muzzin out of the lineup. The first one is whether Kevin Gravel or Paul Ledoux is going to slot in. And I think I can't be the only one who forgot about Kevin Gravel. I kind of assumed that Ledoux would slot in. But because Gravel is a left-handed shot like Muzzin, it looks like he's going to get first crack at the lineup tomorrow. And I posted a chart that is going to make it into a Jules article today or tomorrow or Friday that shows how Stevens doled out ice time when Jake Muzzin was injured earlier this season. And Kevin Gravel was averaging about 15 minutes a game while Muzzin was out. Granted, that's February or January, I think, as opposed to the final stretch. But I guess we'll start with Sarah. How do you think Stevens responds to Muzzin's injury? We kind of know what he's going to do with the personnel, but do you think he leans super heavily on Doughty and Forbert and Martinez and Muzzin, or does he still try to spread the ice time around?
I think he leans on the veteran guys. They talk a big game about, Gravel and Ledoux are, part of this team, and we want them here, and we know they're going to contribute, blah, blah, blah. But, like, unless Gravel comes in and has, like, a really great game, I can't see him, giving him a ton of minutes in a tight situation or, although this is the same guy who keeps putting – I love John Stevens, but also keeps putting out, like, Nate Thompson in, like, the last minutes of a game where they have to score a goal. So, like, what do I even know? But I do think that he's going to lean on those veteran guys. Like, Drew Doughty would play 35 minutes tonight if anyone let him. We'll probably see more of Dion Phaneuf for better or worse. I think that, Gravel, or if Ledoux gets in, they're just going to have a really good game to really crack a milestone on the minutes in any of these games.
Yeah. Robin, do you think Gravel has a chance to have a really good game tomorrow?
No. Based on Stevens' past history, and he's kind of doing the same thing that started, and that he's going to claim that he's trying, maybe he won't claim it, but it seems from the outside that he's trying to protect the young guys and protect the rookies by not putting them in a situation where they could get overwhelmed and make a mistake, and that mistake will end up in the back of your net, blah, blah, blah. But then he'll throw out the veteran guys, as Sarah said, Phaneuf and Doughty, and he'll definitely overtax the veteran guys because it's like, oh, veterans, they know what they're doing. But I think that he's really going to give Gravel a chance to screw things up, for better or worse, as Sarah said. Sorry, Sarah, I'm stealing all your words here.
I think Sarah will allow it. For Gravel and Ledoux, Gravel and Ledoux have no playoff experience, of course. Gravel played 5 games in 2015-16, and he got a lot more time last year, as did Paul Ledoux, but they were getting a lot of minutes for a non-playoff team that, at least for the last couple months of the season, was pretty apparently not going to be a playoff team. I think it's an interesting conundrum for Stevens, who may decide that he wants to play Gravel Thursday and then slots in Ledoux on Friday. I assume if, as Robin has suggested, that Kevin Gravel is not going to have an amazing game on Thursday, or more likely that he wants to sort of give each of them a shot before he decides who to ride during the final week of the season. Ledoux has sort of the edge in terms of what he's done this season. Ledoux, his possession numbers are excellent as far as the team goes. In his 9 games, he's got 3 goals, which Kevin Gravel, I don't think, has 3 goals in his career. I think he's got 1 goal in his career. So Ledoux has the edge in terms of scoring. He's gotten more ice time, I think, in the past than Gravel has, although they've both gotten decent minutes. These aren't 10-minute-a-game guys. So, Sarah, if you had your way, do you think do you put Ledoux in on Friday, or are you waiting and seeing?
I think I'd wait and see. If Gravel comes in and has a fine game, like, you know, one of those games where you don't notice him. He does his job, like, nothing spectacular. Yeah. I feel like I would probably not want to mess with a good thing. Gravel is a little bit more of a physical player than Ledoux. I feel like that's been one of the biggest, you know, minuses in Ledoux's game in terms of how the Kings like their defenseman to play, is that he's not an overly physical guy, whereas Gravel has maybe gotten a little more comfortable with being that sort of, you know, light someone up in the corner kind of player. So in a game against Anaheim where, you know, these two teams are both fighting for the same playoff spot, essentially, I feel like they're probably going to want someone more like Kevin Gravel in the game. But I think it may have a lot to do with how well he does on Thursday. I mean, I feel like if he makes a couple big glaring mistakes that end up in the back of the net, we might not see him again for a while.
I think that's probably a safe bet. I guess circling back to Muzzin, Robin, what situation do you think they're going to miss Muzzin the most in?
Well, Muzzin is kind
like
of a... Mm-hmm. Oh,
wait,
go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say whether it's more a special teams capacity, whether it's, you know, they're going to miss him because it's someone they can put out with Follin for a while, if they're going to miss him in sort of late game situations. I'm just curious on that.
Well, the nice thing about Muzzin is that he's kind of that perfect combination, or he's evolved into this perfect combination of who Gravel and Ledoux are. Because when he first came up, he was sort of like Gravel in many ways, in that I guess he's more like Ledoux, in that he just kind of made some glaring mistakes, but he also had that offensive knack. And then he sort of evolved into kind of a physical player that can roll with the punches and the guy that can go into the corner and lay the big hit if necessary or whatnot. So, I mean, in terms of where they'll miss Muzzin, I think they'll just miss him all around because he's just kind of a really good player to have situation.
Mm-hmm. Sarah, do you kind of agree on that point, or is there another area you wanted to focus on?
I think I agree. They're also going to miss his great beard. That
of course,
no one else.
That's intangible.
No one else can meet that.
I can't believe I missed that.
I'm just picking up where you were leading all the steps to the beard. Like that, I just had to finish it out for you. but I was just thinking about how the last time that Jake Muzzin was out, and like it seemed like everything went a little topsy turvy. But it was kind of all around. So I really do think that like there's not one specific area where they're going to miss him. It's just going to be everything. Like, and you don't realize that you miss him until he's not there. And then you're like, come back, Jake. Please come back. So it might be a little rough.
Yeah, and it's a shame because Muzzin was having a really, really good all-around season. I think he was obviously a little lower in possession because the entire team has done that without Sutter. But the goals against numbers have been so much better for Muzzin. And he's been getting ice time in all situations, which isn't necessarily different, but the power play has taken a huge upturn in the last few weeks, and the penalty kill has been strong again as it's been most of the year. So we'll save some of that talk about how the Kings are going to adjust and mostly whether they're going to be able to lean on Martinez and Phaneuf for a little bit later in the show. But we'll go ahead and move on to a couple of the other young guys like Gravel or Ledoux, who are going to be sort of counted on to produce some good performances down the stretch, even though we haven't seen it much lately.
The difference is that Adrian Kempe and Alex Iafallo have been in the lineup, whereas Gravel and Ledoux haven't had a chance to really chip in. Iafallo has been in, and of course Kempe has been in, and both of them have had maybe their quietest stretches of the season. Iafallo in the last 10 games or so has one assist and zero goals in those 10 games since an early March stretch where he was producing pretty well. Kempe, if you give me 1 second to see what the exact count is, he has not scored in about 3 years, I want to say. Maybe I'm wrong on that, but it's been since February 7th was his last goal. Yeah, might as well be. So, yeah, I was so close. I'm bad at guessing. So both of those guys are going to need to be counted on a little bit more. And Kempe has had he's had some assists in recent games. He's not a total, totally absent on the score sheet, but he is someone whose ice time has dropped in the last few games. And much like Iafallo, I think he's sort of reaching the end of a long season. So, Robin, I'll start with you on this one. What do you think the plan is for Iafallo in these last few games? It looks like Stevens is going to keep him on the first line, but do you think Iafallo is going to get more of a chance to prove himself, or is Stevens more likely going to ride the veterans in the third period and leave Iafallo behind a little bit?
I think it really depends on how the game is going. What it looks like so far with Iafallo's rookie season is that his player usage is very heavily dependent on the score and how well Stevens feels that his team is performing. Like, if they're down a goal and he feels that Iafallo is trying and he's doing all the right things, then Iafallo is more likely to see the third period. But if they're down a goal and Iafallo has kind of been invisible as he kind of disappeared around the, the All-Star break, he got a little, I guess, tired is what Steven said. But so if he starts to look a little fatigued again, as he kind of played out lately, then I think that Stevens will try and save Iafallo for the playoffs. Put him in a situation where he can succeed.
Yeah, and it's interesting because if you look at the way, as you said, that Stevens has used him, he is someone who's gotten a lot of ice time with the score tied, but I think that's a little deceiving because he so often starts early with Kopitar and Brown when the game is still tied. And I think you're right. I think as the game goes on, if it's not a particularly close game, he's going to get his normal run out. But it feels like, especially recently, if the Kings are trailing, in the first few months, you were counting on Iafallo to recover a puck and set something up. And more recently, we saw Stevens loading Carter and Kopitar together on the power play. We've seen him more willing to go to the Carter well when the Kings really need something to happen. And I think that Iafallo has sort of seen his usefulness diminish a little bit. Sarah, do you buy into the theory that Iafallo is at the end of a season that's longer than he's ever played before, or do you think it's just sort of normal growing pains?
Yeah, I mean, I think that he's just hit a wall because he's never played, 70, 80 games in a year before. I think it's normal, and I don't hate the fact that he's occasionally kind of sat him down and, had him, sit out a game to just sort of watch and reset. Iafallo has responded well to that. Every player, coming out of college kind of reacts differently to the grind of the NHL schedule, and some adapt right away and some, do kind of hit that wall. And I feel like he maybe just needs to sort of reset and take a game off or whatever and see what happens. But it's not like he's been playing poorly. It's not like I watch him in a game and I'm like, ugh, like, why is that kid even out there? He's still being effective. I think that we would just like to see him, be a little more effective with goals. And, you know, now that, you know, with Jeff Carter back, they've been able to kind of switch lines up and everything. So it's been giving a little more chance to, you know, rest Diafalo a little more and have him not be playing as much as, you know, maybe he should be, but that's kind of where it is. And, you know, he definitely hasn't always looked as fresh as he has earlier in the season. So, you know, whether it's a conditioning or a mental thing or whatever, you know, it is what it is.
Robin, do you question the handling of Diafalo at all, or do you think it's just sort of a situation that the Kings haven't found themselves in before with this kid who just came straight from college?
I mean, I think it's kind of both, that it's rookie growing pains, but then as Sarah said, that it's just dependent on kids who are just coming out of college, because mm-hmm. they haven't had a guy come straight from college as far back as I can remember, at least under the most recent, since I guess Dustin Brown.
Mm-hmm.
But, I mean, Brown wasn't in college, but I mean, since they drafted Dustin Brown back in, 2003, I think it was?
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, 2003. They haven't had a college kid in a while, and I think it's, with Diafalo, it doesn't look like it's a physical fatigue. It's a mental fatigue, because the game is so fast. I get fatigued watching it. I can't even imagine somebody who is coming straight from college who played 40 games, now all of a sudden his schedule has doubled. And because you prepare yourself, that's what they talk about when they talk about preparation, the mental preparation. You say, okay, I have 82 games. I got to conserve my energy in this many ways. And I know he was going to class and juggling all that stuff, but it's totally different when you're just going to complete grind starting in February where everything's overwhelming.
Yeah, and I think you brought up Brown. Kopitar spent a year playing in Europe and then jumped, and of course there is Doughty, but Doughty's a number two pick and somehow managed to make it through an 82-game season in not great shape, playing 24 minutes a night. So I think he's sort of an exception to every rule we can talk about here. But I think I agree with the thought that he's not necessarily playing badly. It's just that we're so used to seeing him make, you know, 5-10 plays a game that are just little key plays that get everything going. And I think, you know, whether it's because teams have sort of locked in on Kopitar and are trying to block any sort of lane Diafalo might have to make a play with Kopitar, I don't know what it is, really, but I think it's just a combination of a lot of factors that are putting Diafalo in this kind of spot. It's a different situation than I think it is for Kempe, who has been up and down the lineup. Diafalo has spent the majority of his season playing with Kopitar and Brown. Kempe has been with pretty much everybody else. And he's someone whose usage, I think, has fluctuated quite a bit. And Stevens, again, this is with both Diafalo and Kempe. We're not seeing a young player who's not being given an opportunity to succeed. Kempe is getting to play with the big guys, aside from Kopitar. And at least recently, it's just been a failure to score, and he's not getting a lot of shots. He got 5 shots against Calgary, but in the 15 games before that, he had 15 shots on goal. So I think part of what we're seeing from Kempe is he's taking a more passive role in the offense, and maybe that's with Carter coming back in. There are fewer shots to go around, but I think Kempe, the struggle for him is he going to be able to make key plays without having the puck on his stick? And I was there on Monday, and I thought defensively he was pretty solid. I think the guy that we saw earlier this season who has a total lack of discipline, who is a disaster in his own zone, I think that guy's gone away, which is really nice to see, and I think it's the reason he's been playing every night. Robin, what are you looking for from Kempe out of these last 5 games?
I mean, I think it's kind of similar with Kempe in that it's rookie fatigue. I know it's not necessarily the same thing as play that's playing IFL as it's playing Kempe, but Kempe kind of, and this, we've seen this, we saw this with Toffoli, we saw this with Pearson. They get about halfway through the season, and their coaches are preaching defense, 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 and so they kind of get all screwed up in a way, and they sort of start to fit together at the end. So I forgot. I don't know who his most common line mates have been lately. I can't remember, but he strikes the kind of guy who just thrives better with the more highly skilled players. So, like, early on, he was sort of trying to figure out, like, after Carter got hurt, he kind of struck me when they decided to make him a center, which was an interesting experiment. Mm-hmm.
He is an interesting experiment. It's not done yet.
Yeah, he seemed to do really well with, with Carter, and then Toffoli and Pearson, because those are two mm-hmm. really highly skilled players. And I just wonder for Kempe if it's a thing where he thrives better with the highly skilled players. And sure, it's easy to say, well, of course, those kind of players are going to do better with the higher skilled players. But sure. At the same time, you can have, I hate to say this, but, you know, you have your role guys like Trevor Lewis who can mm-hmm. kind of anywhere in the lineup. And Kempe's not one of those guys.
Yeah. And I think it's an interesting point because today's Lions, whether they stick or not, they Kempe is between Pearson and Lewis, so he is getting one of the quote unquote scorers and one of the quote unquote role players on his line. He's below, you know, there's IFL Kopitar Brown, there's Reader Carter Toffoli, and then there's Pearson Kempe and Lewis. So no Nate Thompson in the top nine anymore. It looks like Stevens is probably going to, I would imagine, ride these nine guys down the stretch. Sarah, do you think Kempe back down the middle between Pearson and Lewis is a position he's going to succeed in?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's as good as it's going to get. And like Robin said, Trevor Lewis is that guy who they can put anywhere in the lineup and he'll be successful. You know, in an ideal world, we could just clone, Tyler Toffoli and put him on both the second and the third line, or something like that. But that science hasn't worked that out yet. But I do think that I know. I mean, I've been trying. I have lots of scientist friends, and I'm like, come on, guys. But I think that keeping him with one of Pearson and or Toffoli, you know, whichever one wins the sorry you got booted off of Jeff's mind lottery, will help him. I think that he is a totally different player than at the start of the year. You know, I was looking as you guys were talking, and he's taken, I forgot already, but it's like since the start of February, he's taken like six penalties total since February, which is a lot of games. And it's much better than like the beginning of the season where every night he was taking a really stupid like tripping penalty or something. So I feel like he's really locked down the kind of defensive responsible player. And now he just has to rediscover the offense. And I think that, pairing him with at least one skill guy and one Trevor Lewis is as ideal as we're going to get. And then the fourth line is just an interchangeable group of dudes who hit things.
Mm-hmm. Dude, and dude on the fourth line. Kempe has, like you said, six penalties since the start of February, actually only one in March, which is, I think, even more impressive. That it's, again, he's playing a little bit less, but not much less. And he's still seemingly taking the body. He's been playing center in some of those games. So it's not like he's being pushed into a role where he doesn't have to play defense. He's seemingly coping much better with these sort of assignments he's been given.
And I think that it's, yeah, I think it's encouraging, even if the goals aren't there. Quick update before we move on to talking about Jeff Carter, everyone's second favorite part of the JewelCast. The Flyers and Avalanche are underway. We are 7 minutes in. It is still 0-0. And as Paulo Cruz pointed out to me on Twitter, thanks, Paulo, the starting goaltender for Colorado tonight is Andrew Hammond, past Ottawa regular season goaltending extraordinaire. Apparently, Varlamov was sick today, and they called up Hammond and have handed him the start. So an interesting late twist for that one, but so far neither team has scored. I will alert everyone immediately if either of them scores. And if you're listening to this on a day that is not March 28th, I'm sorry. I'll try to keep the updates to a minimum. So let's talk about Jeff Carter. So Carter, since our last podcast, has, what's the word, scored a lot. He's at 10 goals and 7 assists in 22 games. He's come on really strong. The Kings haven't gone on the unbeatable run that I was hoping they would once Carter was back in the lineup, but he's certainly done his part. Sarah, any thoughts on what Carter has brought to the table?
I'm trying to phrase these in like a family-friendly, clean way that like won't have Blue lose respect for me, which is a little hard when I have to start thinking about like what Jeff Carter brings to this team. Like, if he's been ridiculous, like, I know like last year everyone kind of wondered like, is it a fluke? Like, is this just like Jeff Carter's last grasp? Like, when's he going to decline? He's old. He's so old now. Hockey, everyone's old. Like, if he had been here for a full year, like, I can't even imagine. Like, he's basically almost like at a point a game, or like almost a point a game. Like, he's perfect. That's all I got.
Robin, care to expand on Carter's perfection?
Well, he certainly has re-upped the beauty quotient on the team. So
important.
There's that, at least. Because even missing two teeth, he is still really damn pretty, and it's not fair. in terms of, like, his play and stuff, it's just...
Yeah, all that.
yeah, you know, back to the hockey stuff, if we must. But, sure. Yeah, in terms of, like, what he brings to the team, it's there's a thing that... I forgot which game it was, but it was one of the early games where the Kings had to, well, not maybe early, it was like maybe his fifth or sixth game back, and the Kings were kind of dragging their feet a little bit. And then all of a sudden, Jeff Carter comes out, and he just, like, takes over the entire game, and it's like the entire team wakes up. And I think they ended up winning that game in overtime. I don't remember which team it was against, so I couldn't tell you specifically, but... It was just like in the third period, you know, in the second period, they were kind of a little lackadaisical. And then the third period comes and Carter makes this like amazing play, as Carter does. And all of a sudden the team was like, oh, hey, we can score and stuff now. Like, okay, yeah, let's do it.
And it could be any number of things. Yeah, but I think... you might be on that Vegas game, the second game after he came back, the Kings gave up a goal to go down to right at the beginning of the third period, and Carter scores a power play goal to get the Kings within one. He's on the ice for the game tying goal, and that game he was again. This is his second game back, and Carter plays over 19 minutes. He puts up a 67%. Corsi 4% and he has 10 shot attempts all on his own.
Yeah, I mean, it's the veteran presence, but it's also just literally the skill that Carter brings. He can make plays and draw the attention to himself. That's why he does so well with, you know, with Tyler and Tanner, his other two sons. skill and the veteran presence combined. It's a lot different than Kopitar, who does have skill and veteran presence combined, but Carter is very much a drive to the net and you come take it from me type guy.
And I think we haven't, you know, even in all of our effusive praise of Kopitar, we've never thought of him as like the high skill guy in the sense that we think of Carter, where everything comes to him effortlessly. This is the first season I can remember Kopitar taking guys on one-on-one and really sort of beating people individually on a regular basis with the puck, whereas usually he's just sort of so sound and everything. But yeah, you're right. That's been Carter's game for so long that I think we missed it so much this season. And even with Kopitar sort of barging in and deciding that he was going to do everything for this team, it's, you know, nice having that back for Jeff to be bringing that game.
If there's something that I may add, Eric, it's like Kopitar's game for so long has been very much two-way. Like, it's been pounded into his head since he was drafted, and Terry Murray has been like, you have to be defensively sound. And I know that was always the big knack on Carter, and Carter's, you know, fine defensively, but the thing about Kopitar that always drove me crazy, especially under Satter, is that he would drive the net, and then he'd go around wide to look for another way to set up the shot, whereas Carter's just like, look, either you take it from me or I'm going to score on you. Like, he doesn't go around the net. He just goes to the net.
Yeah.
Like, yeah. Kopitar's doing that a lot more this year.
And I think that, yeah, and I think that's getting lost in a lot of this Hart Trophy talk, is a lot of the people who are talking about Kopitar's case outside of L.A. are sort of glossing over the fact that he was missing Jeff Carter for 50 games. That Kopitar was a one-man show, not just because he's outscored everybody, but because literally the top scorer on the team last year just had a giant cut on his leg that wouldn't let him play for a few months. It's, I think that's, you know, if you talk about the location of the Kings and the West Coast time zone difference hurting them, I think that's where it hurts most. Not that people can't see how good Kopitar is, but that sort of the circumstances are not as familiar as if, you know, you had, for example, Sidney Crosby injured and Evgeny Malkin plays really well. Like, that's, everyone's going to be aware of that. So it's, yeah, I think that Carter certainly, even if it hasn't really borne itself out in the Kings record, I think he has brought back that sort of skill element. And he's also, I think, made things a lot easier for Stevens in that he's not forced to try and place people in roles they're not capable of filling. The last thing before we get past the forward talk is was with another guy who's been high up on the scoring totals this season, is Dustin Brown. I guess we were waiting for Brown to cool off, and I think he did to an extent earlier this season. I think before Carter's return, he was scoring a little bit less, I think.
Plus minutes, seven games, the game against Calgary, and he's continued to put shots on goal. He's continued to play the game he normally plays, but he's also been getting the points. He's got 9 points in his last seven games, and he and Kopitar, of course, are continuing to form their effective combination. So let's open it up a little bit, Sarah. Aside from the guys you talked about, and if you can include Brown if you want here, but who do you think is like, which forward other than Kopitar and Carter are you going to have your eyes on down the stretch to really make a difference?
I want to say Dustin Brown, just because kind of, you know, what you were saying of, you know, just the great bounce back year he's had. You know, there's been a lot of press that's come out around him with the Masterson nomination and, you know, talking about how he really, you know, had to bounce back from some less than great years, you know, for whatever reasons, Daryl Sutter, in the past couple years. You know, and I think that he definitely has a chance to be kind of a difference maker, both on the score sheet and just being that sort of physical presence that we all know and love him for. I also am going to cheat and just mush Tyler and Tanner into one person. And
that's so much cheating.
You know, I know, but you didn't tell me I couldn't cheat. Come on. I need one of them. I don't care which one, really, to, like, just get on with it and make some magic. Like, I need more magic from him.
I got to set more ground rules on this podcast. This is ridiculous.
You really do.
So, Robin, Tyler or Tanner, who are you going to say? Or both?
Okay. Well, I have to go with both in the sense that Tanner is having having a really quiet, productive year. I think he's, what, at 26 goals? So he only needs 4 goals to hit 30 again. And it's like, wait. All the attention has been on Kopitar, and rightly so, but you almost kind of forget that Tippel exists and that he's having a really good season. But I also have to talk about Tanner, because Tanner is also having a really good season, but not in the way that most people think. So people are, like, bitching and moaning. Sorry, they've been griping and complaining. Very long.
You're allowed to curse. Fine.
they've been griping about Tanner Pearson not scoring goals. I think he's up to 10 or 11 goals now. I'll have to check. But he's also on pace for his highest point total ever in his career. Because he's gotten a lot of assists. And people are overlooking that he's gotten a lot of assists, but for some reason he's not getting any goals.
Yeah, and it's been a JewelCast tradition for me to gripe about how Pearson hasn't been scoring enough goals and then look at his assist total and realize, oh, right, he's still chipping in. But he is at 15 goals now. So that's, I think, sort of the breaking point where, oh, yeah, that's a decent tally. And I think he picked it up at the beginning of March. I think fair answers all around, even if you both deliberately disobeyed me and decided to mention multiple players. Those are the other forwards that we needed to recall and hope would find their way. So, quick update. Philadelphia has taken the lead in Colorado. It is 1-0. Hooray, hooray. And the goal comes from somebody else who is being covered up by an ad. Thanks, NHL.com. Oh, it's Claude Giroux, who also has a heart case of his own, but we don't have time to talk about Claude Giroux. Sorry, Claude Giroux. We're still rooting for you. What was that, Robin?
I said 60 plus assists. There you go. There's the heart talk for Giroux.
Okay, good. Thank you. We got it out of the way. He's having a very good season. Good job, Claude Giroux. I knew you had it in you, even though I thought you didn't have it in you. Let's talk real quick about the last sort of aspect of these upcoming games that we hadn't talked about, other than will the Kings actually manage to win them. The next two games are tomorrow and Friday. We have Arizona and Anaheim facing the Kings. And the sort of question that hasn't really been addressed is how the goaltending is going to shake out. Stevens has admirably stuck to his plan of not giving Jonathan Quick back-to-back starts. Campbell's gotten 3 starts. He's done well with them. And the sort of point, I think, of promoting Campbell was to say, okay, we trust you as a backup now. However, it's easy to see a scenario where Stevens decides to throw all that out the window with 2 huge games and decides to start Quick back-to-back. Sarah, what do you think Stevens does, and what would you do?
I'm pretty sure the Quick's going to play him. I'm pretty sure the Quick plays them both. Anaheim might as well be a home game. Would I like to see Jonathan Quick play them both? No, but I feel like I'd probably make the same decision. I'd probably, you know, at this point, just go for it.
Yeah, I don't envy the decision here, because he's going to catch plenty of crap either way. And I think, I don't think there's any question that Daryl Sutter would have started quick in both games. But Robin, are you in agreement?
Oh, I don't know. Because last year he was going to start Jonathan Quick in back-to-back games, it was, you know, like two cheer games. And I think it was actually the Vegas back-to-back, and he started Campbell,
yeah.
And Campbell did really well. And you know, because John Stevens has been here long enough to see Daryl Sutter and Terry Murray overtax their starting goalie. So he's seen,
sure,
what happens when Quick is overworked. But at the same time, if you lose by, or if you miss the playoffs by a couple of points, are you going to look back on this game and go, I should have started Jonathan Quick? Of course, you can also point to a myriad of games, Blackhawks game, and say, you know, hey,
yeah,
we had the lead in that game, and we blew it. With our starting goaltender.
And yeah, and Quick is at 59 starts on the season, which is going to be his lowest for a healthy season, at least, since the year before the Kings won the Stanley Cup. The
which
past
year,
couple, Eric, seasons. What was that?
I said, which year, Eric? You got to be specific.
The year before they won the... Oh, yeah, no. The first Cup, the 2010-2011 season, he only started 60 games. And that was largely because the year before he started 71 games, which would be mind-boggling if he didn't also do it in
2014-15.
Yeah.
How did he miss the playoffs?
It's incredible. But then, yeah, I mean, he wasn't bad that year. He just was his normal self. But yeah, it's Stevens has managed to ride Quick less than Sutter, just sort of by either by happenstance or because Darcy Kemper played so well. But yeah, it's a fascinating decision, and I think it's one that there's going to be a lot of disagreement on. And I think that, you know, I thought going into the season that Arizona, like, was the reason that Campbell would be fine here, that two of his games were going to be against Arizona being a bad team at the time. I thought it was going to be an easy decision for Stevens to let Campbell play the Arizona games and let Quick focus on getting some rest before his big rivals. But it's Arizona's been playing well, and this is the furthest thing from a sure 2 points. I think Stevens is going to stick with Campbell. And that's a gut feeling as opposed to sort of a what my brain tells me, which is that Stevens is going to, you know, maybe shrug his shoulders and say, well, Quick's our guy. But I think heading into the last five games, assuming that Quick is going to play the last four, I think that this is sort of an opportunity for Stevens to say, okay, we trust Jack Campbell. We trust the Kings to take care of Jack Campbell. I guess we'll find out more tomorrow. Thoughts before the regular season actually ends. First, Robin, on what Quick has done this season.
This seems to happen as outside of the 2012 season, the 2011-2012 Stanley Cup run season. Jonathan Quick has this period of time where he just, I don't know, he gets either mental fatigue or physical fatigue, and it just kind of starts hitting the back. And it starts happening around December, usually around the same time that the Kings are starting to lose, like, super close games, and the whole team just kind of mails it in. I don't know if they're related or if it's coincidence, but it's a hell of a coincidence if they're not related. Anyway, it's a moot point, but I do kind of wish, or do strongly wish, that Stevens had trusted Kemper enough and said, hey, Quick, I don't care if you're a highly competitive guy. Kemper's playing well right now. We're going to trust Tim, and you're going to work with Billy Ramford until you are getting, like, whatever it is that's ailing you. So that's my wish, even though it's a moot point.
Yeah, and I think for what it's worth, I mean, there's, yeah, I don't think there's anyone complaining about Quick's play the last few months. He's got a 926 since the start of February, 926 save percentage, that is. So no problems there. But yeah, I think that midseason rut was an interesting opportunity for Stevens to, you know, cast his lot, especially as a coach who maybe doesn't have the built-in loyalty that Sutter might have had. But again, I think that the way the Kings have dealt with Jonathan Quick this year, I think every other team would have done the same thing. I guess, Sarah, are you expecting Quick to steal any of the games down the stretch?
I mean, it's Jonathan Quick, so he'll probably steal one of them. And it'll probably be, like, a game that he shouldn't have had to steal, but he does anyway. It'll probably be, like, the Dallas game. It'll be, like, the very last game, and we will somehow allow Dallas to get, like, 50 shots on net. Like, just because why not at this point?
Yeah.
You know, but, yeah, I think that he, especially if, you know, the team kind of continues this, like, one up, one down, like, play a good game, play a bad game kind of trend, mm-hmm. that he might have to steal one and or more games down the stretch to keep things where we want them to be.
Yeah, and I think the Flyers are up 2-0 now, by the way. Thanks to former Kings legend Jordan Wheel, who had an assist on the goal by Provorov. So the Flyers are heading into intermission with, or at least 44 seconds away from a 2-0 lead. We'll see how that goes. As for the sort of season ending here, I think we might be coming to the end of the podcast here, just because we are nearing the end of our list of topics, and we may be getting a call from James, but I will keep everyone updated. The Kings haven't played a game 82, I think, with any real importance since probably the first Stanley Cup year. Robin, I will specify, the first Stanley Cup year, when the division was up for grabs in the last game. Recently, although they've made it tough going down the stretch, and they've held their playoff clinching towards the end of the season, the last couple seasons when they've been knocked out, in 2014-15, they were eliminated second to last game of the season. And I'm not ready for a winner, like a winner gets in playoff game at the end of the season. But it's, you know, it's going to be a test for this team down the stretch either way. For the last few games of the season, I guess, Robin, the last opponents, again, we've got Arizona, Anaheim, and then, Colorado, Minnesota, Dallas, or maybe Minnesota, Colorado, Dallas. Any of those games you're particularly worried about?
All of them. okay, so the thing about Arizona is that they're finally healthy. So they would have been a bubble team if, you know, Antti Raanta hadn't gotten hurt at the beginning of the year. So, and they've been the hottest team since the calendar turned to 2018. So you can tell that Antti Raanta is finally healthy, the team is feeling good, and, you know, things are finally starting to kind of click for them. But I'm also really worried about the Ducks game, because, as you said, this has the potential to really mess with the or either team, I guess. It really has the potential to mess with the either team down the stretch. And I remember, I think it was 2015, when they missed the playoffs and they lost to Calgary in like the second or third to last game of the season, and it was just like must win game. You're technically still mathematically in it, and they just they shit the bed.
Yeah, and that was I believe the game before that was a defeat to Edmonton, I want to say, but it was a last sort of a similar situation, I should say, where they were playing a team that had almost nothing to play for that ended up spoiling their chances until Calgary dealt the final blow, and Calgary being the other team that was in contention for that last spot. So pushing those parallels all the way out of my head, Sarah, for the Colorado-Minnesota-Dallas stretch in the last week, are there any of those you're particularly worried about, or is it just sort of Colorado by virtue of the standings?
Colorado by virtue of the standings, but, like, I was kind of joking but kind of not about the Dallas game because Dallas has been, like, terrible, but also at times they've been able to turn it on and, you know, they still have very good scorers. You know, Tyler Seguin's one of those guys that when he gets the puck, you just sort of are waiting for the goal to happen. I could very easily see the nightmare scenario of game 82 being a win and you're in, lose and you're out kind of thing, and seeing it all come down to that game. So I'm a little terrified for that one.
Yeah, maybe we're getting ahead of ourselves. I think we are, but that's our whole job, to worry about the last couple weeks. So a couple notes on that is, first of all, Paolo and also Jay Zaris, esteemed contributor, they're both pointing out the back-to-back situations, which I forgot to mention earlier on, talking about the way the calendar was set up. Arizona is one of several games down the stretch where they are on the second game of a back-to-back playing against the Kings. The only one that goes the other direction is that Anaheim game, of course, the second half of the back-to-back for the Kings, where Anaheim is fresh, having had 2 days off, 2 days off from yesterday's game against Vancouver. So the Kings get Colorado as well in the second half of the back-to-back, and they get Dallas in the second half of back-to-back in the last game of the season. So lots of interesting scenarios here. But let's just I guess we've already talked about whether the Kings are going to get in. We've talked about which other teams can sort of contend there. So I think we'll go ahead and wind it down. The last thing I guess that I had listed was the Martinez-Phaneuf pairing, and I was hoping that we'd have James on for that one as well. But we'll have to leave Robin and James to argue about Dion Phaneuf for a later podcast. In the meantime, for both Sarah and Robin, we'll go with Sarah first, I think. Phaneuf Martinez, are you worried about that pair getting more minutes down the stretch? Do you think it's going to be sort of the way it's been, where the possession numbers are bad but the goal numbers are not too bad, or are you just sort of curled up into a ball when they're on the ice?
I definitely worry about it, because they've had their moments where I'm like, what in the world are both of you doing? Like, they don't always look like they're on the same page, and Alec Martinez is kind of doing his own thing, and Dion Phaneuf is just sort of there, like a very large person. I'll have a lot less to complain about if, like you said, the numbers kind of stay the same, like crummy possession, but at least the puck isn't going in the net. You know, like, is that ideal? No. Yeah. But, you know, as long as they're not getting scored on, you know, half of the time they're out there, I'll take it. But, you know, especially with Muzzin being out, and, you know, I know that they're going to lean on, you know, Phaneuf more and lean on that pairing more. And I'm a little wary of what's going to happen with them. I don't think that we want to see 25 minutes a night of Dion Phaneuf, but we might be. The answer may be all of your scenarios, because I may end up just, like, curled up in a ball by the end of the season if things get out of hand.
Yeah, and Phaneuf, it's I'll give Stevens a couple things here. First of all, Phaneuf, I think his ice time is a little inflated because he is so often out there on the power play. It doesn't seem like Stevens has decided that he's going to ride Martinez and Phaneuf ahead of like a Doughty or a Forbert or even a Jake Muzzin. The other thing is that Stevens has been using Phaneuf more often when the Kings are trailing, when they need a goal, rather than sort of protecting leads. And I think that was something I was worried about, was Stevens going to decide that Martinez and Phaneuf are his guys when the Kings are clinging to a one-goal lead. And instead, he's sort of used them normally in that situation. But with Muzzin out, Robin, do you think that Stevens is going to use this opportunity to hand Phaneuf and Martinez those sort of big pressure-packed shifts, or do you think he's going to stick with what he's been doing?
That's a good question. Honestly, the reason why Phaneuf struggled so much, or at least one of the reasons why Phaneuf struggled so much in Ottawa, was his inflated time on ice. So as long as he recognizes that, as long as he may keep Phaneuf's ice time to something somewhat manageable, then Phaneuf should have a good, he should be okay. But I think he's going to lean really heavily on Doughty and Forbert in particular. Martinez probably on the power, like Martinez and Phaneuf probably power play, and any time that they need to really score a goal, especially late in the situation if they are on the power play. But I can't really see Steven throwing Phaneuf out there into situations where he knows that Phaneuf is going to fail.
Yeah, and I think that's fair. I think Phaneuf, his ice time has decreased from when he was in Ottawa. He's getting 19 minutes a game. He's getting his probably 2 or 3 minutes on the power play every night. And the even strength scoring obviously has not been a factor for Phaneuf this season, but he also has not been getting burned, at least by goals on his own end. I think the lack of foot speed is kind of troubling, and I've been noticing more plays recently where Phaneuf has sort of had a puck that was just so this far out of reach, and you know he decides to take a better defensive position rather than going after it, which is not something that you see from like a Jake Muzzin or a Drew Doughty too often. And you know, if it works better for Phaneuf, that's fine. But it is a little maddening sometimes when you know the Kings need a clear and Phaneuf decides that he's sort of going to retreat back towards his goalie and, you know, try again another time. It's a different concept than we see from a lot of the Kings forwards and defensemen. So that's been interesting. But yeah, I think if Doughty and Forbert end up getting the sort of shifts that Muzzin is leaving on the ice, like you suggested, I do think that's pretty likely. And I think that this is after about 2 years of the two of them being paired together. This is sort of gut check time. And Forbert, I think, has wavered a little bit over the last few weeks in terms of his decision making, in terms of his play in his own end. But I think he's at least ready for this these types of shifts with Doughty. Now, whether they hang on is another matter. Sarah, are you confident in the defense for these final five games?
I have to be, because they're the only defense we've got. I think that if they play up to their fullest potential, if they, you know, if we think back to some of the best Kings games that we've seen over the course of the year, if they play like that, they'll be fine. I don't want to know what happens if they don't. I have faith in them. I think that, you know, Jake Muzzin kind of brought it up after, I think it was the Edmonton game, about how they're just not always, like, emotionally prepared to play or whatever. Like, I feel like a lot of their mistakes, aside from, you know, what you brought up about Dion Phaneuf and being not quite as fleet of foot as some of his other teammates, you know, a lot of their mistakes are mental, like not, you know, so if they can get through that, if they can get over that bump, I'll have a lot more confidence in them. But they're all we've got. So I've just got to sit back and hope that, like, you know, Derek Forbert plays like we want Derek Forbert to play and not like he does.
And, you know, in spite of the complaints, in spite of even Martinez, who I think is sort of sliding by on this podcast, because I think I've seen some criticism of his play the last few weeks, aside from the shot blocking, you know, this is still the team that has given up fewer goals per game than all but one other team in the NHL. It's a team that, whether it's due to Quick or due to the defensemen or the, again, the shot blocking, which, you know, the Kings have managed to outplay their possession numbers to an extent because they are blocking more shots. It's, you know, it's a unit that even without Muzzin has a chance to shut down opponents. And that, you know, is fairly well balanced. And I think I'm more comfortable with the third pair and even with Kevin Gravel and Paul Wadu than I have been in past seasons. So it's I think it's a big question for the Kings over these last few games, but I think despite the way that the three games without Jake Muzzin went earlier this season, the Kings are not doomed because Muzzin is out of the lineup. They're just going to have to adjust. So we're about to hit our 90 minutes. I think we'll go ahead and leave it there. So final question for both of you. Robin, how do you think this shakes out? What do you think the Kings' record is in these last five games, and is it enough to get in?
I think that I'm going to be optimistic here, which is a change for me, so be proud, guys. I think that they can squeak in. I think that they're a slightly better team than we've seen this year. So I think they can do it. And I think they'll probably go 3-5, 3-2 in their last five. I don't know if it's like 3-0-2 or 3-1-1, but some combination of winning three games and they will get in.
Yeah. Cool. Sarah, same question.
Robin stole my answer.
Good.
I was also thinking 3-2 and that they squeak in. I'm going to say one of those two losses is probably like a really demoralizing overtime loss or something that has us all like frothing at the mouth on Twitter. So I'll put that one out there.
Goalie interference. Don't even I'm just hoping
but they clarified the rules now. They clarified the rules, so everything's going to be perfect now.
Yeah, I agree. Having more people to argue about it is going to totally clear these things up. I think that adding more people into the decision will help. What was that?
Totally, what can go wrong?
Yeah, nothing. Nothing at all. And that's why I agree with both of you. Before the season, we all sort of predicted that the Kings would manage to squeeze out that third spot in the Pacific Division. And, you know, we've stuck with it for 6 months or 5 months. Why change now? I think that the Kings beat out Anaheim. I have no idea how Colorado and St. Louis shake out, but I think the Kings squirm in ahead of Anaheim. And if they do that, I won't even complain about the playoff matchup. That's how desperate I am to see the Kings make the playoffs this season.
Sure.
So I think that, yeah, I know. Like I said, I am not going to bring up the playoff seeding. I am not going to bring up who they would have to play in the first round. I will cross that bridge later.
Fair enough.
Fair enough. Okay, with that, with the season coming to a close, with Philly having a 2-0 lead on Colorado, and with us having talked about pretty much every player on the team, I think we'll call it there. So we will have another podcast, depending on how the rest of the season shakes out, either right before or right after the season ends, and hopefully that will be a chance for us to talk about the playoffs. If it isn't, then you'll know by the sounds of our voices on that JewelCast. So Robin and Sarah, thanks again for jumping on tonight. I know Sarah, you've been sick. So thanks for making the time, Robin. I know it's, later than you wanted to go, but thank you too. And, thanks to everyone who listened. I saw there was an uptick in listeners for the last podcast. So thanks to everyone who's sticking with us, and we'll hopefully have another one for you in a week or so. Thanks, everybody. Good night.
Thanks, guys.
Bye.